Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. It is lovely to see you all here on this beautiful wintry day. Thank you for being with us. Again, this is our last Thursday Morning Roundtable session of the year, of the calendar year. We will be back after the semester break. Though I want to remind you that you can listen on WCNY FM. They have podcasts of all the past programs, so if you miss the group, you can listen or re-listen to the programs there. As you know, this morning we're going to be speaking with Dr. Casey Craybill, the new president of our community's college. But I also want to remind you that there are some other things going on in the community. Tonight, for instance, Thursday, December 12th, downtown is the Jingle Mingle, a new event for shopping and dining. And at the same time, while you're downtown, make sure and stop by the Onondaga Historical Association. They'll be having a book signing. One of our very own members, Arnie Rubenstein, wrote a history of his family's company, United Radio. So that's tonight at the Onondaga Historical Association. Also on Monday, December 16th, the League of Women Voters is going to be co-sponsoring an event on the Moreland Commission. That will be downtown, and I'm sure if you go to the League of Women Voters website, you'll find information. Hopefully there's information in the news, and it's also posted to the Onondaga Citizens League Facebook page. So lots of other things going on besides the holidays and the new year, and I want to take this opportunity to wish everybody happy holidays and safe, and enjoy your Thursday mornings after this for a while. Right now, it is my pleasure to introduce one of our newest TMR regulars, Diane Kupperman. Diane is the president and CEO of Make-A-Wish Foundation. And while I'm thinking about it, charities, we also have a Salvation Army kettle for you if on your way out you have some spare bills or checks. And, of course, throughout the community, remember those who are in need in this season. Thanks. Thanks, Diane.
Good morning. It is my privilege to introduce the 8th president of Onondaga Community College. And to help with the introduction, Sandra sent me a very impressive document highlighting the jewel that sits atop of Onondaga Hill, Dr. Craybill's very impressive career, and her upstate New York roots. Much of that information, actually all of that information, is available on the web, and if you haven't checked it out yet, I encourage you to do so. But I wanted some more personal insight on who Dr. Craybill is, and I can tell you, first and foremost, she is accessible, and she is a great sport. So, I'm happy to share 7 top interesting facts about Dr. Craybill that you won't find on Google. Number 7, who had the most influence on her career? While Dr. Craybill was in high school, her mother went back to nursing school at the Hudson Valley Community College while raising 3 children. That shaped her early views on higher education. But in addition to her mom, it's her grandmother who most influenced her life. Though not formally educated, she was perhaps the most talented and smart individual that Dr. Craybill has known. Number 6, books. What's her favorite and what is she currently reading? Dr. Craybill's partial to anything by Virginia Woolf and most of the late 19th century novels. A slight departure, she just finished Leadership in the Crucible of Work, Discovering the Interior Life of an Authentic Leader, a new textbook written by an old friend, Sanford Sandy Shugart. Number 5, opera. Dr. Craybill has one daughter, Catherine, who is studying opera at the New England Conservatory in Boston. With an opera scholar in the family and an incredible opera company here in town, I wondered what her favorite opera is. Taking top billing right now is Tosca. She and Katie saw it in Rome the summer before Katie applied to conservatory. It's a heart-wrenching opera with a tragic story about love and loss. Number 4, favorite course in college and favorite teacher. Dr. Craybill's favorite course was Victorian literature. And her favorite teacher is her 5th grade teacher, Bill Schwartz. No one has ever come close to the level of care, creativity, personal connection, and belief in students. Maybe until now. Number three, thoughts on women in leadership. Dr. Crabill was the first female president at Raritan Valley Community College and joins an impressive list of women in leadership in our community. I wondered what excites her most about women in leadership. Other than the fact that it's nice to have company, Dr. Crabill is generally excited by engaged leadership, whether demonstrated by men or women, as that generates great opportunities for energy and collaboration. Number two, her greatest wish for OCC. Dr. Crabill has influenced tremendous changes in her career and previous positions. Her greatest wish for OCC is quite simply, she would like to see OCC lead the nation in student success. Number one, the greatest challenge facing community colleges and the role of the community in overcoming those challenges. Somewhat surprising, but reflecting back on Dr. Sharon Contreras' presentation last week, perhaps not, Dr. Crabill sees the lack of student preparation as a key challenge. The community can help by shaping kids' lives around hope and helping to build resilience. The other bit of information that you won't find online, but it's readily available on the Hill, is the impression that she has made on the faculty, staff, and students at OCC. When I asked a few how they would describe Dr. Crabill, they said, unbelievable, extremely smart, sincere and personable, down to earth, collaborative, and above all, genuinely loves students and unquestionably, their best interest is at the core of her motivation. We are extremely fortunate to have Dr. Crabill in our community. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Casey Crabill.
Thank you. It's a great introduction, and it was really fun to get those questions yesterday and think about, geez, I don't know. usually it's the got her degree at, and this was just a lot of fun. Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for your kind invitation this morning to be here at the Thursday Morning Roundtable. It's a great pleasure, really, to share some perspectives with such an esteemed group. I was really interested in the entire idea of a Thursday morning roundtable. I understand this started in about 1965, and I think that there's really such room and such need for great civic conversation. So I'm really happy that my new hometown has this opportunity, had the foresight to develop such a forum, and really the fortitude to keep it going. When I think back to 1965, and I am old enough to remember it, that's a time when civic forums really were so necessary to help move us forward, to bring together business, social, agency, economic leaders, people with a passion for communities, to talk about the things that were pressing. And when I think about where we are today, I think the challenges we're facing are no less daunting, and probably the need for civil discourse even more necessary. So what you do here has a profound impact on this community and by extension on your community's college, Onondaga, and so it's in that spirit that I join you this morning. I'd like to begin, though, by extending my appreciation for what has been an amazingly warm welcome from the people of Central New York, from students and parents to community leaders, elected officials, citizens, neighbors, everybody that I've connected with, including my colleagues on the Hill at Onondaga, as well as the folks that work in my new favorite places to sneak out for lunch. It's just been an amazing welcome and has reminded me of my time growing up in Albany, the warmth of the people I knew in upstate New York, and so pleased to have that sense of upstate here in Central New York and happy to be part of that again every day. I am a lifelong educator. And to me, the people part of my job is what's most important. And as you might expect, first and foremost, those people are my students. You might know that the vast majority of OCC students will remain in Central New York after graduation to live, to work, and to raise their families. National research on community college completers notes that 85% of community college graduates will live within 25 miles of that campus for the rest of their lives. If you think about that, and if you're thinking about building the future of this community, that future is being built on the hill that houses Onondaga Community College. And it's critical for all of us that those students have an opportunity to put their education and skills to work in a vibrant community. And it's critical to all of us that they have the opportunity to very carefully and deliberately develop those skills for the future. While there's no doubt that Syracuse, like many other communities, has its challenges, I believe those challenges can best be addressed by a better educated citizenry. We have tremendous assets in this community, many of which are represented here this morning. So I'd like to spend my remarks talking about a few issues that are critical to the success of your community's college. Those issues include student remediation, meaningful opportunity, and workforce development, all set within the context of the community college mission. These issues are by no means confined to Onondaga Community College, but rather they are the focus of discussions like this across the country with both civic organizations, such as the Thursday Morning Roundtable, with business leaders, and on college campuses. Having had both the privilege and opportunity of serving at community colleges on both coasts and a few places in between, I can assure you that these issues are not unique to Central New York, even New York State. They are by no means Onondaga issues, but I think they are issues that will shape our collective future. You're probably aware that OCC has experienced tremendous growth in recent years, and while that pace is starting to level off, we are currently enrolling more than 12,000 students, and that headcount number shows a 21% increase in the past 5 years. So you can imagine the pace of growth that drives you up 21% in a compressed period. You can imagine some of the growing pains and challenges that come along with that. But in response to this growth over the past 5 years, we've also had tremendous support from our local sponsor, Onondaga County, and from the state, each of whom has invested in our capital plant. We've had more than $100 million in renovation of existing facilities to meet the needs of today's students, and in the development of new facilities to make sure that we've got the room to educate these students, but also the tools necessary to educate them, not just for today, but for the future that they hope to build. We opened this fall, perhaps you saw in the news, our newest facility, Academic 2. It's an uninspiring name, but a really nice building. This facility has added critical capacity. It's given us 8 new smart classrooms, which are completely technology enhanced. It's also provided a home for our signature music program, which for 25 years has served in temporary space in the Gordon Student Center. At the same time that we experience growth in our enrollment and in our capital investment, we've also experienced another kind of growth, and that's not a positive one. That's the number of students who come to us needing remediation. That is, they are underprepared for college-level work, even though they may have the drive, the ambition, or even a goal that requires a college education. What they don't have are demonstrated fundamental skills necessary to engage productively in the first-level college work. The National Center for Education Statistics, which is a federal agency responsible for collecting and analyzing data related to education at all levels, reported out in 2013 that in public two-year colleges across the country, like OCC, approximately 24% of students were enrolled in some kind of remedial coursework. These courses do not carry college credit. They don't count toward anyone's degree, but they're designed and taught to prepare these students to become college ready. As a public community college in New York State, Onondaga is by charter an open access institution. This means fundamentally that anyone who's earned a high school diploma or an equivalent credential such as a GED can enroll. Now, some of our programs have specific entrance requirements. Nursing's a good example of that, where students have to demonstrate capacity beyond the enrollment requirements. But for the most part, unlike many of our counterparts in higher education, we accept everyone. This is fundamental to community college history. The first community college was founded in Joliet, Illinois in 1901, so we've got a little bit of history, but the majority of institutions like OCC are somewhere between 50 and 60 years old. In fact, back in the 60s, there was a period of time across America where a new community college was opening every week. These were largely founded in the post-World War II era to serve the large number of returning vets and a growing number of people seeking a college education, which had previously been reserved pretty much for the elite. Community College's open access policy was designed to serve citizens at all socioeconomic levels, regardless of circumstances, they would have a chance to go to college. This is actually what drew me to this work in the first place. As a community college professional, I am fundamentally committed to this mission. But the mission has created the need for remediation across the country, and that is deeply concerning to us as institutions, as college presidents seek to figure out how to stretch resources across a broader and broader spectrum of need. So what does this mean at OCC? Well, in the fall of 2012, 2,944 students required some form of developmental or remedial level courses in English, in reading, or in mathematics, and sometimes in English, reading, and mathematics. We know from research on student progression that these students who are unprepared for college level work are the least likely to retain and to complete a degree. These students, for us, are the most profoundly at risk. As you are aware, community colleges serve a diverse population. In fall 2012, our most recent demographics, 36% of our students were adult learners. That is, they are students who are above the traditional college-going age of 18 to 22. These are students who have been out of school for a while, so you can understand that they might need a brush up, and they are enrolled in large part in remedial courses. From an age perspective alone, though, that this means that for our same year, fall 2012, about 64% of our students had recently earned their high school diplomas. The top feeder high schools for Onondaga Community Colleges in 2012 were, in order, Cicero North Syracuse, East Syracuse Manoa, Liverpool High School, followed by Henninger Nottingham in the city school districts as number 4 and 5. The diverse population of students we serve includes a rich ethnic and racial diversity, a large proportion of student veterans, students who maintain full-time or part-time employment while working toward their degree, and students who have families and children who depend on them. In short, our population of students who work really hard in school, at home, and jobs in order to achieve their goal of a college degree, a goal that they might not have been even tracked for since birth, but rather one they have built along the way, have many challenges in front of them. We believe that this develops grit on the part of our students, and in my book, grit is a pretty good thing, but it also builds challenges that create, for some students, a fairly steep incline between entrance and completion. In any case, the concern that I have about remediation is this. We know that students who enroll at remedial level courses are at risk for not completing their degree. And if you think about what Diane said about my wish for OCC, that we're the number one institution in student success, that stands in our way. Many of our students invest limited resources earned at minimum wage jobs, qualify for full financial aid in form of TAP and Pell grants to meet our tuition of about $4,000. Sometimes this requires loans against themselves and their families. So we understand that they are stretching and scrimping their resources to patch together so that they can progress through the remedial coursework necessary to enter college level. So the combination of weak educational preparation and economic capacity create a difficult situation for many students, and this has a key impact not only on their future, but on ours as a community. Most of you might acknowledge at this point that a college degree, once thought of as a luxury for 24% of the population, is no longer something that we can cast aside for only a few. The Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce released in 2010 report that found that by 2018, 63% of job openings will require some kind of college education. In contrast, when I left high school, 25% of the workforce needed a college degree. Of course, you were going to have one job for the rest of your life, so it was a little easier to prepare. So you see the complexity of the world that we're pushing students out into, combined with the challenges that they face, create a scenario that's difficult. I can share with you, and Diane shared part of it, a story from my own family. When my mother returned to college, a community college, as an adult, she had raised us. My youngest sister entered first grade, which was full-time, and my mother said, now it's my turn. Went back to community college, became a nurse, and I learned through that experience, not at the time, I was 16 and knew everything then, but upon reflection of that experience, I really understand the potential for community college education, not just on the impact that it has on the student who's able to achieve her goals, earn a degree, get a job, feel successful, but also the impact on the family to follow. Once my mother completed college, there was no escape for my sisters or for me. A college degree made possible for her a high-paying job that changed the financial picture for my entire family, and that is the driving force between community college professionals across the country. The issue of remediation, then, and the cycle that often results from missed opportunities for retention and completion is our top priority. We are firmly focused on the systems, the processes, and the programs that a college can provide that will support retention and completion for those students who are the most profoundly at risk. At the same time, we are reaching out to our K-12 colleagues to identify and address the college preparedness of high school graduates, not when students are applying to college and facing remediation for which they have to pay, but while students are still engaged in high school. And really even reaching back before that to support pre-K and grade level reading campaigns for young children, understanding that it is the full continuum of educational experiences that lead to college readiness, not a magic moment in the 12th grade. However, if we can identify students who have a goal to complete college or have the need to complete college, but who are not on track to become college ready, while they are still in high school, this gives these students and the teachers and schools who work with them the opportunity to remediate and catch up before college. This takes the best advantage of the educational resources and the expertise that are available in our secondary schools and also saves students and their families significant financial resources, both in terms of their own resources and in terms of the limited financial aid available from the state and federal sources. So when we work to strengthen our focus on the remediation issue as a system of education, K-12 and post-secondary education working together toward common goals, we'll begin to slow down the spiral of remediation and be able to support retention and ultimately completion of college degrees. So let me give you an example of something we're doing in that field that we're very excited about. And I think you may have had a preview if you were here last Thursday listening to Superintendent Contreras. She mentioned the PTEC partnership that includes the Syracuse City Schools, the Manufacturers Association of Central New York, affectionately known as MACNY, and Onondaga Community College. PTEC stands for New York State Pathways in Technology Early College High School. An early college high school is a model that rather than create the disjuncture between high school, it creates a pipeline that goes from the end of eighth grade through the completion of the first 2 years of college. Our PTEC program focuses on advanced manufacturing and works to create an all-important bridge between secondary and post-secondary education as well as business. So the curriculum is being developed jointly by the City School District and OCC with significant leadership and input from local manufacturers, and it will serve students who will graduate in a 5-year period with a New York State Regents diploma and an associate's degree from Onondaga in either electrical engineering technology or mechanical technology. And this associate degree will come with no cost to the student or her family. We've aligned this program with the National Association of Manufacturer Skills Certification System, affectionately known as NAM. Students will graduate with these credentials that mean something in the world of work. The PTEC program is an excellent example of a public-private partnership between post-secondary and higher education, secondary schools, a trade association, and private industry. Upstate New York, like many areas of the country, and certainly many parts of the Northeast in particular, has been ravaged by job losses in manufacturing. But we see a rebirth, if you will, in small shops that have been engaged with the educational sector. The PTEC program seeks to address a growing area for this industry in which there is increased stability, high-paying jobs, high-growth jobs that manufacturers in our region are struggling to fill. You might have heard some discussion. They're called typically middle skills jobs. These are technical level jobs that students need some scientific background, some physics, some preliminary engineering skills, understanding of things like mechanical and electrical systems. So the PTEC program will be built starting with students out of the eighth grade to build the foundation both in science and math, but also the technical skills that build on that. And the employers will provide job shadowing experience, internship experience, so that by the time students leave us with their high school diploma and their associate's degree, they will have both the technical capacity but also a sense of the industry. By preparing students while they're still in high school and earning an associate's degree concurrent to their high school diploma, you end up with a work-ready student for an industry that has high demands. This program is funded by New York State, should impact more than 6,000 high school students spread out among 16 winners across the state, including right here in Central New York. It will include, as I said, mentoring programs, job shadowing, career fairs, and internships, and the goal is a seamless pathway through high school to college to employment, using curricula that's designed with the needs of industry. This is an opportunity that community colleges take advantage of and something that's really fundamental to part of our mission. We will take this employer-led approach with a number of our other work-based programs. When I came to OCC, one of the things that I brought with me is an approach to curriculum development called DACUM. That's a fairly inelegant acronym. It stands for Developing a Curriculum. It's been around for about 40 years, but I don't believe it's been heavily used in this region. Essentially, it's an approach to occupational analysis that brings in people who hire as well as expert workers to advise educators on the skills, knowledge, and ability necessary to be a successful worker in a particular field. In other words, what does it take to achieve expert status? The facilitated process includes interaction between a trained facilitator and expert workers in the same job across an industry, so you get perspective from different employers. In their focus on skills, knowledge, traits, and abilities, they help through a storyboarding exercise to explain to educators how a job is done, how is the task analyzed, and what is success measured against. It's important to note that this process is what we call credential agnostic. It's not important for us to know whether it needs to lead to a 2-year degree, a 4-year degree, or a certificate, or even if it has to bear credit. What's important is that it produces a curriculum that employers understand and that prepare students for the jobs that they envision, not what the institution or someone with a collegiate faculty perspective thinks is necessary for inclusion in a workplace program. It allows us to directly align college programs with the needs of employers and with the needs of the emerging workforce. Students who are successful in completing a DACUM design curriculum will have the skills and attributes, knowledge, and behaviors necessary to be productive in a job environment from the beginning, and employers will have a complete understanding of how students are prepared, so it enables a stronger match. Going forward, the Dakin process will be the structural basis for Onondaga Community College's workforce development programs. We have a long history of working directly with local employers and industry. Some of these programs are through our non-credit arm and include such things as the Center for Business Information Technology, computer skills, and certifications offered to on-site programs such as Lean Six Sigma, customer service training, and the like. In our credit program, we have a couple of examples also of workforce preparation programs, including our brand new Nuclear Technology Associate's degree, which was developed in partnership with Constellation Energy to make sure that we can help them address their concerns of an aging workforce. Workforce programs at the community college fill the serious need for a skilled workforce in a community and help students find the right path to high-paying jobs in industries that are being impacted. We look to expand programs such as these and develop new programs, again, using this credential-agnostic approach, using DACOM to work with businesses and identified industries where there are high-demand, high-wage jobs, where our programs and services can connect the needs of people in our community for work to the needs of employers in our community for skilled employees. Essentially, this is the mission of a community college. If you think about it, there are three parts. Number one, transfer. Everybody's familiar with that. You think about us as the first 2 years of a bachelor's degree, whether the student goes on to SU or Oswego or Binghamton or Cornell or anywhere else. The second piece is the workforce preparation, students who come to us because they want a job, something that requires more than high school. The third part of our mission, the remedial arm, making sure that our open door is really open. If you come in and you're weak in mathematics or you're weak in English and reading, we have a program to get you through so that you can access either our transfer preparation or our workforce program. Essentially, as a community college, we have the privilege of being designed and driven by the community we serve. Each of the nearly 50 credit programs we offer and the multitude of non-credit programs we provide must serve the needs of local students and families, local industries and employers, and citizens of the community whose support, in part, funds us. That's what makes community colleges both unique and, in my humble opinion, exciting. In closing, I'd like to thank Sandra and the Thursday Morning Roundtable for their kind invitation to be here this morning and to all of you for your interest and support over the long term for Onondaga Community College. It's a pleasure to live and work and contribute to this community. I look forward to furthering this work collectively. We need all of you to keep us on target because you are the community that we serve. I look forward to some good questions, and I thank you for your attention this morning. So that's a great question, and I'm going to answer it in three ways. Programmatically, we want to make sure that our employment programs are rooted in local industry and that our students are retaining and completing to degree. From a capital standpoint, I have one more project I'd like to complete. Our library was built in the early 70s, and if you think about what's happened in the world of information technology since then, we'd like to renovate the library and be able to take advantage of some more of the current technology in that facility. And I think in terms of our current size, about 12,500 students, I expect 5 years from now we'll be somewhere between 13,500 and 14,000 students, given three things. One, we are continuing to draw an increasing percentage of high school leavers from all of our feeder high schools. We think this is because families are beginning to understand that they can stretch the funds they have available for a bachelor's degree by spending them a little more wisely on the front end. We are the lowest cost alternative for the first 2 years of a college education, and that's starting to be part of people's awareness. The second reason I think we'll be about 1,000 students larger is that we're starting to see more and more adults wanting to increase their employment portfolio. They're coming back to school, maybe not for a degree, but to develop some technical skills or add to their capacity or their attractiveness or to move up in their positions. And finally, we will do a better job at retaining students, so we've got some students who come in, put a foot in the water, leave for a while, come back, start again, and that's fairly inefficient. So we want to get to them and say, hey, this is a serious enterprise. You're spending resources. We want to focus you. We want to get you in through and done. So I think that's where we'll be.
Good morning.
Hi.
He probably didn't think I could talk loud enough, so she brought the microphone. My question goes to, I understand the basic mission of OCC as other community colleges is to prepare workers for a local economy. And you mentioned Constellation Energy in relationship to PTAC or whatever. I wonder if you could expand a little bit more of what other types of companies that may have some unique requirements for their industry or their particular company that may come to you and you really tailor make a program just for them. I understand you've done a lot of that. I just don't know what the magnitude of it is.
Sure. So a couple of things. When a company comes, we try to find out in the community who are their who's in the same sort of business, because if we can develop a program that's maybe a little more generic, we can serve a broader group of students. And what we typically hear from employers is that there are some fundamental baseline skills, whether that's in the manufacturing technology, you know, can you use this kind of a press? Can you, it usually starts more basic. What are their measurement skills? How do they understand material science? What about testing and quality control? So you can stretch those skills across a number of industries. So you want to start there from a fundamental level. And a lot of employers will say, once they have those fundamental skills, we'll take them because we want to train them in a proprietary way on our process with our materials, and we really would rather not tell you about those things. So that's kind of the most typical. And I would say in our manufacturing technology lab, if you walk through there, 2 years from now, those kids will be dispersed at various industries, and many of those industries send their HR folks and their frontline supervisors actually into our classrooms, both as guest lecturers, because it's exciting for the students to meet people who are doing what they want to do on a regular basis, but also on, you know, recruiting forays to see who's really good at those skills and try to draw those students in. The same is true in our electronic media programs. If you go to any broadcast entity in Central New York, most of the technicians have at least a significant amount of coursework, if not a degree from OCC. It's great when I go in to do a TV or a radio interview. I don't get out of the building too easily because I've got alumni all over the place. They want to tell me about their experiences at the college. So those are our typical workforce programs when we take a broad-based look at an industry. On the other hand, we have specific companies like Constellation that you mentioned that come to us and say, we have a niche need, and it may not be forever, but it's really driving our business right now. And so we can work one-on-one with the business, everything from a short-term training X number of people on a new computer program that the business wants to begin to use, all the way up through a process redesign and creation of a new set of technical skills for a workforce on the floor. That happens less frequently because, as I said, those things tend to be more proprietary. I will also tell you that the thing we hear most frequently from employers is a concern about soft skills. Give us somebody who shows up on time, knows how to listen to and speak appropriately with a supervisor, can account for the use of supplies and equipment, understands there's a bottom line to the business and has a regard for that bottom line. And so in each of our workforce programs through the DACOM process, you're able to build in instruction and assessment of those soft skills so that when you say to an employer, and we think this is our responsibility, when we say to an employer, this person is ready, we mean those things too. And we want to share with employers how we're teaching those skills and how we're testing them.
Good morning. Given the difficulty for some students, perhaps non-traditional students, to reach your campus, what are your thoughts with respect to off-site locations, classrooms and other locations? Are you in favor of that? Are you going to build on that or contract? Or what are your thoughts?
So community colleges do tend to be infused, but we're also financially constrained. So I'm not a person who looks to build a second campus, if you will. I don't think it's financially practical to figure out how could I have another registrar, financial aid, library in another location. What we would like to do is more in partnership. Perhaps in the neighborhoods, if there's space that's available for a class that would be appropriate, that there'd be a demand for, and that maybe that demand would last for two cycles and then not be present again for another 2 or 3 years, really to become more integrated into the community and to work with schools, agencies, folks who can identify those educational needs, rather than to establish a standalone campus that would duplicate in some ways things that we're already supporting. The other thing is just to continue to work with the folks responsible for public transportation to help them understand, you know, where do our students come from, how long does it take to get there. We have some students who persist 2 to 2.5 hours on the bus to get to us. That kind of drive makes me feel good about their future but frustrated about their present. That's a lot of time when you could be studying or working. We do have a small north site up in Liverpool, and I think there's an opportunity for us to do more robust programming there, and we're in good conversation with the Liverpool School District at this point.
I'm fascinated with the remedial program. I think you said that there were about 2,900 students in the remedial program. So how does it work? What percentage of those students will actually, you know, go through the remediation and then be prepared? And how do you do it?
So that's a great question. You know, it's one of those programs where you've got to blend not only, and I taught remedial English for a really long time, so from an insider's view, you've got to blend not only the teaching of English, in my case, which mostly for college students is writing skills, right? When I got out of college, it's when Time Magazine's cover said, you know, why Johnny can't read and write. And so that's the world of higher ed that I entered, and there's been a lot of time spent on figuring out how to build those skills in people. But also, if you think about the perspective of someone who's gone through a fair amount of education and not yet assimilated those skills, you also have to build the kind of study habits and a respect for the academic enterprise and a commitment to homework and a sense that it's possible to learn these things, which may have even been difficult for the last 16 or 17 years. So it's both an instructional program, but also I think we're cheerleaders, we're organizers, in some cases we're nags, to make sure that you're on it and you keep working on it. For many, many students, they experience that difficulty in math. There was a great article in the New York Times last spring about algebra is the great gatekeeper to a professional life. And if you talk to many, many students, their deepest fear is that you'll assign them to an algebra class because it's that uphill, something they haven't quite got. I'm very proud of our math department because right now we have 5 different experimental pedagogies that we're comparing to see what's the best way to get students over this hurdle. And we're also working, there's a group out of the University of Texas that's taking a look at the entire world of mathematics and saying, you know, for these careers, what's the most appropriate math? Is it algebra for everybody, or really is it a grounding in statistics that would make the most sense for people who are going to confront numerical questions in the course of their professional life but maybe not have to calculate the square footage of anything? So those kinds of things go into the program design. And then your other question was, how many of them get through? And I would say the first time, about 50%. But you do see students cycle back. And ultimately, I would say we get about 3/4 of those students through the remedial program. And many of them then persist on and are able to tackle college work. The ones that are in my laser focus right now are the ones that can't get through the remedial program, because when I look at the world of work, I'm not sure what's there for them.
Susan, do you still have a question?
Yep.
I have a two-part question. The first is the percent of your 12,000 that are full-time versus part-time. And the second is what the percentage is of those that come to your campus on a daily basis and then go home, or those that are living on campus or off-campus housing because they live outside of the Central New York area.
Okay. So we're about half and half, slightly more full-time than part-time, but we split about half and half. And nationally, that's the case with community colleges. And the interesting thing is a student who is full-time this semester is just as likely to be part-time next semester and then full-time again in a year or so. You see this sort of non-traditional approach to enrollment in community colleges because 80% of our students are working 20 to 30 hours a week. So if you think about that, you know, you're 18, you can do anything. You can work 40 hours a week and go to school 40 hours a week and do 40 hours a week of homework, and you can party 40 hours a week. But you get a little past 18, and it gets challenging. So you see students full-time, part-time, it's kind of a swirl. We have 876 students who live on campus. I don't know how many students live in apartments in the area, but when we look at our overall enrollment, the large, large majority, in excess of 90% of our students, come from the five-county Central New York area.
Yep. You had a question?
Yes. Quick question. Could you tell us about the character of your faculty, full-time, part-time, and also what are your faculty needs?
So I have 200 of the finest full-time faculty you will find anywhere. They are outstanding professionals, and I say this because any of you who have worked in a university environment, my faculty carry a 15-credit-hour teaching load.
Yay.
That's significant. That's a huge teaching load. And they are professionally active in their fields, and they write and publish, and they serve in community college committees, and they support the many agencies and nonprofits of this community. So they are an amazing group of people. I wish I had more of them. And my faculty needs spread across all areas from my English department can always use more. And I'm an English teacher, so they always get my first thought. Math makes requests. In the sciences, we're considering needs in biology, chemistry, and physics, but also in our workforce programs because we want students to have the opportunity to learn from people who've had that workplace experience. Part-time, in a given semester, we have about 400 individuals who teach one or more courses on our campus. Some of those are practicing professionals in other fields who teach after work and bring their lifetime experience to campus. Some of those folks are people who would really rather be in a full-time faculty position. We just don't have the funding for that. But if you look at some people are frequently interested in our full-time, part-time ratio. And again, we're about half and half at this point in terms of our credit hour offerings.
I don't have a question, but I have an observation. My wife and I took in a student in 10th grade who had absolutely no ability as far as going on to college. He entered OCC, went into the general studies program, a lot of remediation type thing, and he ended up as a certified industrial arts teacher after completing his education at Oswego. So this goes back a few years, but it's quite a success story.
Thanks for sharing that. I think the most exciting thing about community college work is that when you first meet them, you just never know what their capacity is. And the thing that makes our faculty so special is that there isn't a student they give up on. So anybody who comes to us, their track record, sometimes you don't even want to know. But we're focused on where are they when they leave us. I had an opportunity last night to celebrate the folks who are graduating in December. We don't have a big graduation ceremony in December. They're welcome to come to the one in May. But we do have a special gathering for them, their friends, their families. And I think they ranged in age from what you might expect, 19, to close to 70. People who... in the 2 seconds that you get to talk with them on stage when they're having their walk and getting their handshake, want to tell you everything that the college meant. And if I ever needed impetus to get up in the morning, I just have to go to one of those events, because students like that who talk about the time they took to build the future. We talk about students, the future that they imagine for themselves. That's really our mission. That's really our job.
I'd like to know if you would address the issue of funding from a donation alumni perspective. People look at community colleges and say they're government funded. Why give any money? Syracuse University, of course, is always out there looking for money from alumni. But how might you address this issue and change the perspective of an alumni for giving?
So that's the community college nationwide $64,000 question. And here's why. If we do our job well, particularly for our students who are graduating, they're either going to transfer or they're going to go to work when they leave us. If they're going to transfer and be successful, we have to practice a little tough love. We have to say to them, you're done with us. Go on. Go affiliate. Become part of that university. Connect with that university. Research on completion will tell you connection with an institution and the ability to see yourself as a graduate of that institution is the most likely predictor of success. So if we send them off to SU or Oswego or Binghamton and pull on them and say, but you're our alum, you're always OCC, we do them a disservice. We have to cut that cord pretty harsh, and it works against us in the long run. We have a fellow now who's Russ Corbin, who's going to help us get back in touch with alumni. We think there are about 400,000 people who have taken at least a half a degree at OCC. We don't know where they are, and we want to hear their stories, in part because we think, you know, history is prologue, and if you can understand those things, you can build a stronger future. But for us, the first part is finding them and finding out where they are and what impact we've had as an institution, to understand, you know, are we of value, and if so, how might we talk about that value? Most of our philanthropic gifts come not from alumni at this point, but from local businesses that work with us, that see a value in what we do to their bottom line, and they've been incredibly generous. We do think that I've got alumni in the county legislature. I've got alumni in the state assembly, and those people understand the role that we played in their current situation and what's likely for them in the future. So that helps us to make the case for public funding. But the philanthropic nut is a hard one to crack.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for your time. I'm interested in your use of DACM. And you mentioned talking to some businesses here and concentrating on soft skills. I see a lack of social and emotional intelligence in the workforce today. Yep. Through your studies, have you considered courses in that? Because you know full well, when you talk to people in industry, they say the ceiling is hit. Once everyone's technical skills are saturated, I need a leader to rise above the rest. Would we consider courses in that to prepare them for the future?
So what we're thinking about is not so much a standalone course, but in the instructional pathway for a workforce program, building the soft skills in through daily assessment in the same way they're daily assessed in the workforce. If you go to work one day and you are a jerk that day, that disrupts, right? It creates an impression of you as an employee. It doesn't help your company, and it's counterproductive. The same thing needs to start from the very first class. So in some places that are doing this, and this is a direction that I hope we'll take with our workforce programs, when the instructor is teaching whatever the subject matter is, at the end of that class, the instructor provides feedback on, you know, what was your interaction like? Were you attentive? Did you answer appropriately? Did you come with your homework done? And begins to give feedback as part of instruction on the same kinds of soft skills that can be either a help or a hindrance in the workforce. Sure.
Thank you. One more question, I think.
Sure.
Thank you for joining us today. And from your reference to Virginia Woolf and your fifth grade English teacher. I sensed you had an affinity for English. And as a history major myself, I always enjoy reading articles saying, you know, liberal arts education is really the best training for life. And my question is, with this emphasis on kind of workforce training, are we moving ever more toward a community college education, which is kind of geared almost like a graduate education toward the skills you need to join a profession? And if so, is the liberal arts getting a kind of short end of the stick?
So when my mom went back to become a nurse, the hardest thing she had to do was read Slaughterhouse-Five, because part of her nurse's education was that English one. And so, you know, on the one hand, we want to make sure that the training is appropriate, but to award an associate degree in the state of New York, there is a general education component. So our liberal arts faculty are as involved in our mechanical tech program as they are in our transfer general studies program. Because if you look at our outcome statements about things like critical thinking, ability to read and use information, those kinds of skills come from, as you expressed, a more well-rounded education. The other thing I know, though, about students is that had someone asked my mother to read Vonnegut when she was right out of high school, that would have been the end of her college education. She had to come to it later, and she was ready for that because she had a purpose. So what we have to do is make sure that we're hitting students at a point where they have the capacity to learn what we're presenting. And for some of our technical students, they come into college and they think, okay, nobody's ever told me I'm college material, ever. We have lots of students who come to us and say, you know what, from third grade it was clear I wasn't college material. So that first step in the college is a huge leap of faith. And they make it because they say, I need training because I want to go to work, and I need to pay my own bills, fundamentally. It may take several courses in the thing that brought them there before they say, you know what, I'm a capable learner, and if I have to take this English course or this history course or this sociology course as part of my program, yeah, okay, I can do that, because in the long run, it's going to get me where I want to be. And it's all about shaping the educational experience around the learner, and that means we need to know them better, and we need to know them more than, you know, number 164893. We need to know their name, their background, their capacity, their interests, what drives them. We have to become experts in 18-year-old, and the older I get, the harder that gets. But that's the driver.
Thank you. Thank you,
Dr. Casey Grable. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.